Amanda is a third-year doctoral student in the College of Communication at UT Austin. Her research explores the role social and cultural norms play on health behaviors and how persuasive communication can influence perceived norms, attitudes, and behaviors. Currently, her focus is on gender stereotypes, masculinity, and femininity, and how cultural norms contribute to the prevalence of sexual violence. Taking a public health approach, she is interested in mass communication approaches to preventing sexual violence.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm the last presentation, but I'm kind of going to take a step back. So for this project, I was asked to come in and help the Voices Against Violence office that do the interpersonal violence prevention work at UT through the Counseling and Mental Health Center, and they already had something set up. So I wasn't going through the traditional formative research and things like that. I was just kind of, well, for this campaign. What it ended up being, and I'll show you, is that this is going to be some of our formative research for another campaign that's hopefully a little more strategic, I'll say. But so I have no relationships to disclose. So today I'm just going to talk a little bit about sexual assault and consent. I focused in on this project on the posters part, although we know that a social marketing campaign is not just one element, and this campaign at UT entails a lot of other things. But this was specifically what they asked me to look at and help with for the next version of this campaign. So as many of you probably know, sexual assault is a serious concern among college students. About 20 to 25% of women and 6% of men will experience a completed or attempted sexual assault while in college. This leads to immediate physical and emotional trauma, but also longer-term issues such as depression, PTSD, and survivors are at a higher risk for developing many chronic diseases. Now, inherent in sexual assault is the concept of sexual consent, because the most basic definition of assault is sex without consent, although it's much more complex. But that's often what we talk about. But there's actually relatively little research on how students interpret consent and understand consent, and even less about how they might respond to any sort of marketing or mass-mediated effort to influence their perceptions of what sexual consent is. So at UT, we work under the communicative model of consent, which is getting a lot more attention right now. California just passed the Yes Means Yes law, and that's based on this model that says, you know, all parties need to be comfortable with what's going on. Just because you say yes to one act in an intimate encounter doesn't mean you're saying yes to everything. And this contrasts with kind of a more stereotypical construction of consent, which is a contractual model, where a dominant partner, often the male, offers sex or something of that nature, and then a passive partner, often female, either accepts or declines. So we're, I think, generally moving towards a more communicative model. So for this study, since the materials were already done by the student organization that's run out of Voices Against Violence, we decided to use them as kind of a starting point to do some primary research on how students understand consent, how they feel about the messages that are already out there. So for that reason, we focused on the posters, although, as I said, there's a lot of other stuff going on at UT, such as peer health educators, website, all sorts of things. And we hope that this will inform future social marketing campaigns. So we did a qualitative online study because we were asking some really sensitive questions, and we felt like we might get some better responses that way. We ended up with a qualitative content analysis. So my co-author and I went through, created a code book. Then during coder training with two undergraduates, we further refined the code book. And then myself and the two undergraduate coders read everything and individually coded. And then we came together and reached consensus on any items that there was discrepancy on. So our sample was 137 students. The average age was 20. The majority of them were female and white. And we did ask about their organizational involvement because we know certain organizations in the literature, individuals in them are at a higher risk of perpetration. And then most of them were sexually active. So first we asked about their perceptions of consent. So I'm going to show you a chart that's got a lot of stuff on it. But so we asked them both how they recognize consent and show consent. And that's the two bars to your left, or the two graphs to your left, you'll see that the red bars are nonverbal cues. So students reported more than double the number of nonverbal cues in consent than verbal cues. And what's interesting is there were only like three or four different ways that they talked about verbal consent, but there were a lot of ways they talked about nonverbal consent, from looking someone in the eyes to taking off your clothes. So this is consistent with the literature that exists. And then we asked about their non-consent too, and this was interesting because we see a lot more people saying that they would verbalize non-consent, or they would wait to hear a verbal non-consent from their partner, but also still they relied a lot on nonverbal cues. So that's definitely interesting and good information for our future research, particularly the nonverbal cue part. So now I'm just going to go through and show you the poster campaign that they've already developed and that's out on our campus right now, and give you just kind of a sense of how students perceive it. One of the ways that we coded was whether they got a constructive message from the poster, so something more than "I liked it" or "it sucked," and that's how we coded that, although we did get some of that. So the first one, the tagline is, "No one's asking for it unless they're asking for consent," and that's at the bottom of every poster. And then there's kind of a larger block of copy that addresses one particular issue with sexual consent. So this is "Consent is a conversation," and it's two people talking about how comfortable they are with what they're going to be doing. So over 77% of our students found some constructive meaning or something that we felt was useful from this poster. This person talks about how there should be a conversation about consent every time. The "should" probably indicates that there isn't a conversation about consent every time. The next poster is "Consent is an enthusiastic yes." And our students, 60% of them found something constructive out of this, talking about how saying yes means that you want to say yes. You're not just feeling pressured by the moment or pressured by the person. So in general, they're getting a lot of the messages that the students who created the campaign were hoping that they would get out of it. So that's encouraging. This one is funny to me. It's three girls going out for the evening, and it says, "Consent is not an assumption." And in the text bubbles, one of them says, "I hope no one creeps on me tonight." And the other one says, "Yeah, I just want to dance." So most of our students found something good out of this, talking about how you should never assume that someone wants to have sex with you just because they're out dancing or because of what they're wearing. A lot of the women really felt identified with this poster and said, "I understand exactly what they're saying about this. Sometimes I just want to go out and be left alone." This one addresses alcohol and consent. So it says, "Consent requires consciousness and clarity," and there are some red cups, so it cues a party scene. And our students consistently talked about how consent needs to be sober or a sober decision. Now, before I show you the last poster, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. So this poster could be interpreted in two ways. One is the way our students meant it to be interpreted, and one is how a lot of people interpret it, actually. And it really speaks to the importance of doing primary research and some pilot testing, which we will be doing in the next phase of this study. So this poster was pulled 1 week after the campaign went up because a lot of students told them that the message wasn't clear. So it says, "Consent is always negotiable." What that is supposed to mean is you can, throughout the process, always say no, right? But our students, because we included it in the study, even though it's no longer in circulation on campus, they cued in to this not being perhaps the best message. So while this is constructive, we also labeled it as unfavorable. So most of our students found this poster to be not so good, so glad we pulled it. So this student kind of elaborates on that by saying, "Consent is not negotiable because no means no." And that's what a lot of students said, that they weren't comfortable with this message. So this is kind of how the general population, or the students in our survey, felt about the messages overall, but we also looked at all of their responses and came up with categories and one kind of bigger theme that was important for this poster campaign and for future social marketing efforts in general, and that was realism. So they consistently talked about including images from our university and our city specifically. And actually, these posters do. But what we learned from this is, like, we need to knock you over the head, make it very, very clear, like, Longhorn on my shirt, the tower in the background, you know, very, very obvious cues. And I think that will help with the second bullet, which was a lot of students said you should use UT students. And they did. All of these people were UT students. But I think because they didn't recognize the cues in the rest of the posters, they didn't identify them as students. So we hope that those will kind of go hand in hand for the next time. But it just speaks to the importance of really tailoring your message to your audience and to your campus so that they feel like this isn't just a generic campaign. It's something that's meant for us. They wanted us to include diverse student groups and situations to make it more realistic. So more party scenes maybe at a Greek house, or more pictures of people from a certain organization or something of that nature. And then the last one that came up quite a bit was don't be corny. although some students were kind to us and said we recognize it's hard not to make a poster about sexual consent somewhat corny. But I think that what this is really getting at is the idea of the nonverbal cues. So what is normal, our students in this survey were telling us, is we don't talk about sex. We use these nonverbal cues. So when you see these posters that represent conversations, it seems contrived and it doesn't seem normal. So not only do we need to work on making this maybe less corny, but we also need to address this culture of communication, or trying to build a culture of communicative sexual consent. So for the future, the recommendations that we have and what I will be doing going forward as well is do primary research. It's critically important to having a campaign that's going to be successful for your target audience. Although I think that this one was fairly well received because it was student-driven, and that is our target audience. Although the students who created this campaign are very invested in this topic, so they're not exactly representative of the entire student body. I think that it would be important to integrate theory so that we can evaluate the next set of posters based on some objectives that involve things like social norms, self-efficacy. Consent is kind of a hard one because nobody sees you usually having a conversation about sexual consent except for your partner. So the normative part is kind of an interesting topic, and it's, you know, something that we're working on, trying to get students to talk more about sexual consent just in general, so that then when the moment comes, they'll feel more comfortable doing it themselves. And then something that came up was this idea of no means no versus yes means yes. And as I mentioned before, we're kind of seeing a movement towards yes means yes. But in our data, we found a lot of, like, just stick with the good old no means no. And what was potentially problematic about that is that our students are relying on nonverbal cues, both for consent and non-consent. And we know that when survivors are experiencing sexual assault, often they freeze, right? So there's fight, flight, or freeze. And when your body freezes, you don't say anything, you don't move, you're kind of doing what you can to survive. And at that moment, it's not fighting back. And so if someone is listening for a no, they might not hear it. And we did have a number of responses that didn't include any verbal cues in recognizing non-consent in another person. So that's very something that's problematic and certainly needs to be addressed in the future. So we think that there needs to be a shift to a yes means yes. It's not consent unless you hear a yes, or pulling apart those nonverbal cues too, and how we interpret those in a realistic way. And so that is what we will be doing moving forward as we continue to refine and integrate this campaign. Thank you.
Hey, thank you to all of our wonderful presenters. We've got about 20 minutes for questions. I think what I'm going to do is maybe ask you all, when you're answering, to come up to the microphone so everybody can hear you, and also for the recording. Okay, so questions for the speakers?
I wanted to ask a question, and it could be addressed by any one of the speakers probably, but in relation to social marketing and the use of Facebook to deliver intervention using that media, and we've done some formative work to suggest that it would. Some of your ads were very professional looking, like the one a day and the short videos were lovely. And so any comment in relation to Facebook social marketing for any of you would be welcome.
I've been nominated by the group.
So thank you for the compliment on our ads, too. I didn't have an opportunity to mention that they were professionally done by an agency that we worked with. We did the formative research, and then they actually did the ads. We're in more of an urban/rural setting, so it may be comparable. It kind of depends on which group we're targeting. So when we did our Facebook ads, I actually had one of somebody who's in our coalition said, you must be targeting moms of children aged 34 to 45, because she said, I see your ad all the time coming up. And so that was a good targeting. But we also are targeting senior women. And for our senior women, most of the ones, and I do mean senior, I mean we're talking 75 to 91, I think our oldest participant, we have an intervention as well. That's not going to work for them as a type of media, so we've had to use different ones. So depending on who your audience is, I think the social marketing is a good method. We still have areas of town that don't have good bandwidth, I think pretty comparable, but it seems like Facebook's a pretty easy one versus the YouTube for somebody with low bandwidth, too. That's just my, maybe what somebody else could say. Sure. We actually still have ongoing Facebook messaging. So I didn't mention it in with this, but as part of the larger social marketing campaign, we also have an intervention that's also focused on lifestyle activity. And so we have weekly messages that go out related to that physical activity. And then with the 5210, our overarching community message, that's going out on a weekly basis as well with some version of one of those numbers. So one day we might be working on Gardner's Market with the emphasizing the five. So it's a continual messaging, and I would say our frequency at least three times a week. We have messaging related to one element of that, along with other messaging too. I know the thing we're working on right now is trying to get more conversational, and doing ways that we get a lot more people commenting and feeding. You know, right now I wouldn't. Right, and we haven't really engaged as well as we would like. So it's been a little one way on our communication. So that's kind of the next step is to move into that more. We actually repurposed one of those PSA ads that we used for YouTube, and we used it on television ads. We're now running it in movie theater ads too. So the movie theater one is actually going to be at the movie theater coming up. So I think it's being creative with. We didn't have a huge budget, but we repurposed everything we have. Multiple times and multiple methods. So maybe somebody else wants to.
I had a comment just about for those of you who may be trying to use in your organization, the terminology gets confusing sometimes. So when we talk about social marketing, it's the approach. It's research informed through multiple distribution channels. Social media refers to those specific distribution outlets like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, things like that. I had this conversation with everyone in my organization because when you say social marketing, people think, oh, you're going to do Facebook ads. And that's not it, right? It's much bigger than that. You've heard from all of us about all of the primary research that went into this, how much thought we put into segmenting our audience, there's targeting, that marketing mix. So when you're talking about social marketing, you're talking about a whole plan for how you're going to strategically communicate with your different audiences. And social media refers to those specific outlets that have become much more primary.
Fairly quickly, just a couple of comments. First of all, I think the most important way to answer your question is that what is the value of what you're going to do for them? You know, I always start with that point. Why they should spend time looking at your post, or your video, whatever it is, and that's the first step, I think. And for example, if it's related to diabetes, one of the issues that I see a lot is that you don't know what to cook for people that have diabetes. So just having recipes, you know, at 9 a.m. when you say, oh man, I need to make dinner tonight. So what do I need? So I think that's very important. And as you mentioned, I think you're going to have a lot on mobile. So we go back again to the idea of values. Then you cannot have a 3-minute video from YouTube because nobody's going to spend that time. How do you have a website maybe that is optimal to be looked at in a very small screen, not, you know, the big website that you have to try to scroll. So what is the value that you're trying to get, and not the value of the organization, but the value for the consumer? That would be number one. And the important other issue that I think is, that's what I recommend that to everybody, who's your hero out there? And just follow them in Twitter, in Reddit, in whatever, and how they are using different technologies. And you learn from them. You learn from the best, like some of the projects that we saw today. There are wonderful ways to learn about how we can do our own thing. And you learn by copying others, which, you know, no need to reinvent the wheel in every place.
Given that social marketing is an umbrella over a certain Get it out there and get it evaluated, probably relatively quickly and for a
communication department or advertising department that works on a different model than a lot of public health departments in terms of funding. We do a lot of research just to, you know, without any sort of grant or funding. So I would say that's a great resource and a partnership to build in the future.
One more comment.
I'm a college professor, so I don't live in the real world, so I don't know what you mean.
And I reach out.
What I've heard over and over again is that we need to do, as one mentioned, partnerships. And really, you go back and you do the idea, what is the value that I want to be to make my consumers, at least not education. I know that that's our goal, but why should you open your page? What they should bring you for sure? Based on that, you say, okay, well, who can I partner with? A lot of what we do is about content. So what can I get content that is really interesting, really good for the people, my collaborators to read about? So who's doing that online? And there's a lot of people willing to share information, share links, and so on and so forth. You can start a conversation among different organizations. And again, everybody wants to get more people in their website or in their Facebook page. So you can always collaborate that way in a very cheap manner.
Twitter, none of you have really talked about Twitter much. Anybody use Twitter much?
My patients are not on Twitter, from what we understand. So,
makes sense.
I think
our students are on Twitter, and we do use it sometimes for like live chats or things like that, or just to disseminate. It's nice. You have to be strategic with your 140 characters, but it's so easy to digest that you can just get something out with a quick link. And for our population, that seems to work pretty well in tandem with Facebook.
Okay, I'm so sorry to end this wonderful discussion, but I'm sure our speakers would be happy to answer other questions. If you found this session valuable, it was sponsored by the Health Communication Working Group. So if you're not affiliated with us, consider becoming a member. We have webinars, a great newsletter.